because Andrew Sims is finally gone this week, this is MuggleCast episode 43 for June 11th, 2006. This week's show is sponsored in part by GoDaddy.com. Get your own piece of the internet today and save money along the way. For a limited time, GoDaddy.com is offering a new domain name transfer or renewal for just $1.99 with every new non-domain product you buy. Choose from hosting, website builders, email accounts, and much more. Plus, take an additional 10% off any order simply by entering the word MUGGLE in your cart at checkout. So visit GoDaddy.com and save big. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to MuggleCast, the show where we bring you everything from Harry Potter news, discussions, theories, and a little bit of spy on Sparts. I'm Ben Shane.
I'm Laura Thompson.
I'm Rachel Godoy.
And joining us this week is John Noe from The Leaky Cauldron, PotterCast executive producer.
Hello, hello.
And from the Harry Potter automatic news aggregator, HPANA, joining us is Jeff Gillum.
Hi.
Say hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
It's an acronym.
Without further ado, let's go to Micah Shane for this past week's news.
Thanks, Ben. Now is your chance to get your hands on a rare signed photograph of Daniel Radcliffe. Students from Cambridge University are putting it up on eBay for auction, and the money going to various charities. If you would like to bid for this item, please visit MuggleNet.com. Earlier this week, the British Broadcasting Corporation's Top Gear show conducted an interview with Michael Gambon, who portrays Professor Dumbledore in Harry Potter movies 3, 4, and 5. You can catch a snippet of the interview over at MuggleNet.com. Later on this week, J.K. Rowling was voted the greatest living British writer. In March, she was nominated by the Book Magazine's Greatest Living British Writer poll. And she won first place. Turning to film news now, we saw some Order of the Phoenix set pictures this past week. Things from the River of Thames and the never-ending pictures of Hagrid's Hut. At the Queen's 80th birthday party, Potter stars Dan Radcliffe, Emma Watson, and Rupert Grint will be participating in a kids' playground play to be performed at the Queen's 80th birthday party, according to CBBC Newsround. Other famous stars will be part of the play include Kelly Osbourne, Jonathan Ross, Winnie the Pooh, Mary Poppins, and Postman Pat. The Queen's birthday party is on June 25th. In other film news, we recently learned that Warner Brothers was looking to film scenes in Italy. You can catch a picture of that at MuggleNet.com. Finally this week, signaled the release of MuggleNet's Harry Potter Image Galleries. The galleries consist of over 39,000 images. You can check those out over at MuggleNet.com. So that's all for the June 11th, 2006 edition of MuggleCast. Back to the show.
Thanks for that, Micah. So, Jeff, tell us a little bit about HPANA. What do you do over there?
What do I do? We aggregate Harry Potter news automatically. It's about as simple as that. Now, That's how it started. I actually years and years ago got online and started visiting Harry Potter sites like The Leaky Cauldron and MuggleNet, and I wanted to have all the news come to me so I didn't have to go visit these sites. And I'm not saying that I didn't want to visit the sites, but I wanted to be alerted when news happened and I didn't have to go search.
So you're
for
saying
it.
You're lazy?
Definitely. That was the primary reason, really. And, yeah, it's just evolved into what it is now with, posting news from all around the web.
Awesome. We all know John Noe. He's been on the show again. Welcome back, John.
Hey, it's been some time, hasn't it? When was
episode
the last time
25. Jeez.
Oh, my gosh. That's
feels good to have you back. Well, before we move on to our listener rebuttals, let's go to some announcements that we have this week. Last Friday was National Wear Your MuggleCast T-Shirt Day. Some of the pictures are on the site. You can see those by visiting MuggleCast.com. However, keep in mind that even though National Wear Your MuggleCast T-Shirt Day is over, you can still support the show by purchasing your MuggleCast T-Shirt today. There are two different logos and are available in 5 different sizes. So, everyone, go out and buy a MuggleCast T-Shirt. Sounds good to me.
That sounds like a good idea.
John, do you have a MuggleCast T-Shirt?
I think I got an honorary one last time we were in New York.
Oh, really?
But they were not the new, cool Rainbow Squares t-shirt.
Okay, and the final announcement. Send something, anything you want to the MuggleCast P.O. Box. That's MuggleCast, P.O. Box 223, Mound Ridge, Kansas, 67107. I'm still waiting on those Subway gift cards, people.
Yeah, Ben, and I'm still waiting on my packages.
Right, and so if you guys send me Subway gift cards, I might send Laura her stuff. So
have you been withholding Laura's packages?
Yes, he has.
Oh, okay. They're in the back. They're in the trunk of my car, and I'm just too lazy to.
You're saying they've melted.
That's funny.
Yeah, they've melted pretty much.
That is exactly where Melissa keeps all of my packages that come to the P.O. Box. The trunk of my car.
So you all may notice something different this week. After 42 long and grueling weeks of MuggleCast, Andrew Sims is finally taking a break.
Oh my gosh.
So this is the first Andrew-free show.
That's ever. Crazy.
Wow. I don't know how we're going to make it.
I know. I'm surprised we made it this far already.
I'm kind of nervous.
Me too, dude. I'm worried he's going to listen to this with a watchful ear. You know what I'm saying? He's going to be critiquing our every move.
You will.
Well, he deserves it. He's off editing some video and getting ready for finals week. So,
aww.
Best of luck, Andrew. Yeah.
Don't fail everything, right. Andrew.
Okay, now it's time for this week's listener rebuttals. This first one comes from Susanna, and she's from Texas. Hi, everyone. I noticed during episode 41 that you all seem to think that Aberforth, assuming he is the barman at the Hogshead, and Dumbledore were not friendly. I feel that this is incorrect. However, for in chapter 27 of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, on page 613, Dumbledore mentions that he is merely friendly with the local barman. Dumbledore obviously is in touch, and I think you remember that he seems to know all that went on that night, not only from what Mundungus informed him. I also think that since Aberforth is obviously a member of the Order, it implies that he is friendly with his brother. Thanks. I love the show. Well, since Laura and I were the only ones on episode 41, I think it's appropriate that we feel this.
Yeah.
What do you think, Laura?
Well, I don't think that because Dumbledore said he was friendly with a local barman, that necessarily indicates a friendship or any kind of rivalry either way, because we know that Dumbledore can be very delicate with his descriptions of people and his relationships with them. Just because Aberforth is a member of the Order does not mean they have to get along. But on the same hand, they could. So, I mean, we don't know.
Thank you, Laura.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Susanna for sending that listener rebuttal in. Now let's move on to our next listener rebuttal. This comes from Jessie, age 14, and she's from New Jersey, Andrew's home state. Hey guys, love the show. I just wanted to make a comment about the last episode when you were talking about the Fidelius charm and who it was broken when the Potters died. I was just wondering why would you believe that it was broken when they died, seeing as they were not their secret keeper. Do you think that it may have something to do with the destruction of the house? I'd love to hear your opinions. Much love, Jesse. Well, what I think she's trying to say here is that how are people able to find their bodies? And I think it's that the charm was broken once Lily and James actually were dead. Does that make sense? Laura, help me out here. You were on that show.
Oh, wow. I can't specifically remember what Jo said regarding secret keepers. Didn't she say something along the lines of the secret would only be revealed to the people who the secret keeper exposed to it?
Right.
But
don't you remember in Half-Blood Prince when Dumbledore freezes Harry? Okay. Mm-hmm. And then once Dumbledore dies, Harry's unfrozen. Okay. So I'm wondering, does the charm still apply once the people have died?
I don't know.
Jeff?
If the person that cast the charm dies, is that the issue?
Or do you think, do you think that since Lily and James had the spell put on them, since they died, does that mean that anybody can see them? Because, you know, they were underneath the Fidelius charm, so Peter Pettigrew was the only one that could disclose their location. Do you think that since they died, that's why Hagrid and, I mean, anybody serious could come and see their bodies?
Yeah, I think that's probably valid. Mm. I mean, looking at the lexicon here, when a secret keeper dies, their secret dies with them. So that you could apply that to, or you could infer that the Fidelius charm is the same way.
Good point, Jeff. Good point. Well, that wraps up this week's listener rebuttals. We don't have any voice rebuttals for you this week because Mr. Kevin Steck is off at a wedding and is unable to gather the voice clips. And he's the only one with access to the account. Don't worry, it's not his wedding. Ladies, he's still single.
Oh, but, I thought Kel finally got her break.
Yeah. But yeah, so we'll make sure to have those voice rebuttals back for you next week. And if you have a listener rebuttal, a comment about something that went on in the show, something that you want to argue with us about, anything like that, feel free to send it to mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com. Subject line, listener rebuttal. And it could be put into the show. Now it's time to move on to our first part of our main discussion this week. As we mentioned in the past, that we're going to start rotating the character discussions. And this week is indeed a character discussion week with Mr. Horace Slughorn.
Oh.
A little bit of information about Slughorn. This comes from the MuggleNet Encyclopedia. His age is unknown, but we know that he is younger than Dumbledore, but old enough to consider himself a broken-down old buffer. His distinguishing characteristics are that he is very short and enormously fat. He has a shiny bald head, prominent eyes, and a huge silver walrus-like mustache. He has a preference for wearing waistcoats and maroon velvet smoking jackets. The first mention of Slughorn comes in Chapter 4 of Half-Blood Prince. So, when we are first introduced to Slughorn, what are your guys' initial impressions of him?
Yeah, we're introduced to him in Book 6, which actually... I just started rereading, and I just finished the chapter on him, so I should be more authoritative on this, but I think later in the book we learn more about him. But I don't know. He's my first impression is that he's a power-hungry politico type. I mean, the slug club and all that, he's interested in being popular, right, and being associated with people who are popular. And that's sort of how he keeps his foot in the door, so to speak.
Well, what I like about Slughorn is that, I don't know, he seems like more of a lighthearted guy. Because especially since he was the former head of House of Slytherin, and he's nothing like Snape whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so it goes to show that there are indeed good Slytherins. And I just think that he's enormously fat, that's how he's described. And it sort of makes sense that he's more of a jolly guy as opposed to,
What makes me think he's a good Slytherin? He has a different kind of
okay,
personality.
Okay, well, I'm talking about his outward appearance is what I'm saying. And I know that can be deceiving.
Well, I kind of, touching on what you just said, John, I don't think that he's necessarily a good or a bad person because he'd been in hiding for a year, I believe it was, hiding from various other Slytherins that he knew might come looking for him to try and get him to join Voldemort's cause. And I just think that he's more of a person who doesn't want to side with, anyone either way, and he would just rather live his life on his own and not have to be involved in any of it.
And a lot of the first impression we get from him is that he's very self-interested and he's motivated to do things that are going to help himself. So in that respect, it sort of gives you a sort of, he's sly, Slytherin, stuff like that, so... Yeah.
A little bit arrogant, too.
Yeah, but I think where the Slytherin attributes come from is strictly from the fact that he likes nice things. He's very eccentric. He likes the finer side of life. I don't think it's anything to do with a lot of the characteristics we see in Slytherins like Draco or Lucius.
And he seems to be very, very selective. For example, Jeff brought up the Slug Club. It seems that he's very discriminatory about who he wants to be in that group and who he doesn't want to be in that group.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads you to believe that, it's sort of like at school, if you're on a teacher's good side, they can be your best friend in the world and can basically let you get away with anything. But if you're on their bad side, it's probably not someone you want to mess with. And that's the impression that I get from Slughorn. That it's awesome if he likes you, but if he doesn't, then it's not so good.
Then you're just not even a blip on his radar.
And so I assume in things like the classroom setting, he'd probably focus more on the people that he likes. For example, since the book is written from Harry's perspective, since he's the boy who lives, Slughorn automatically takes a liking to him, and it is for this reason that Harry views him in such a positive light for the early parts of Book 6.
Mm-hmm.
And then, something that Slughorn did is what basically led to the whole Horcrux thing, right, John?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, the Horcruxes. Yeah. What year was it? Voldemort's fifth year or sixth year?
Oh, gosh.
I want to say fifth, but
I think
I'm
it was
sure.
his fifth. Yeah. Someone correct us. Slughorn has been struggling with the guilt of having explained what a Horcrux was to Tom Riddle for many years, due to the fact that Harry's mother, one of Slughorn's favorite students, was murdered by Lord Voldemort some years later. His Hogwarts house is Slytherin, despite this fact, he does not wish to have anything to do with Voldemort's cause, and had in fact spent a year in hiding to avoid involvement. This just goes to show that Slughorn, you know, when there's conflict going on like that, he just, you know, sort of wants to get away. And in a way, he feels really guilty because he sort of gave Voldemort the keys to the kingdom. He's the reason that Voldemort didn't die the night that he tried to attack, that he tried to kill Harry. Mm-hmm. And we all know that in Tom Riddle's fifth year, he approached Slughorn, you know, and he asks him about Horcruxes, and Slughorn reluctantly explains this to him. And what do you think that when Harry has to try to get the memory from Slughorn, the memory of that event actually happening, the fact that Slughorn modifies the memory shows a lot about his personality in the way that he feels really guilty about it and that, you know, he's going to try to cover it up.
Yeah, and at the same time, he doesn't want to be incriminated.
Right, as a man who basically...
Well, it just all goes back to the fact that he doesn't want to have any involvement with this. The reason he didn't want to tell Harry anything was because he didn't want to be involved with the good side and take the risk of known Death Eaters or even Voldemort realizing this and coming after him. And on the same hand, he doesn't want any involvement with Voldemort because he doesn't want the exact opposite happening.
Right. Why do you guys think that he would go ahead and tell young Tom Riddle about the Horcruxes?
Why do you think he knows about him to begin with, I think, is an interesting question, too.
So do you think that he basically told Tom Riddle what a Horcrux is, and then he used that information to his advantage to create the Horcruxes, or was it that he explained some of it to him? What do you guys think?
Could have been that he wanted to either impress Tom with his knowledge, or, it's very evident that he's self-important and, you know, likes to think of himself highly, and so that's one aspect. Or he was hoping that Tom could use it to his advantage and then thank Slughorn later, you know, hold him in high esteem for showing him this or teaching him that. So,
yeah, and why do you think, I mean, let's not forget Tom Riddle, Voldemort, you know, they're still pretty much the same person. What happened in between Slughorn being this guy that helped Riddle figure out about the Horcruxes to turning into a person that Slughorn is afraid to, afraid of Voldemort, afraid of his followers, afraid of being involved in anybody's cause? Why? I don't understand why he feels the need to distance himself.
Because I think that it's that he feels partially responsible for what happened. Because, okay, I think that Voldemort probably would have found out about the Horcruxes some other way.
Yeah. Sure.
Eventually.
I agree.
But Slughorn is the one that, like I said, sort of gave him the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. And Jeff brought up an interesting point saying that he was probably trying to impress him with his knowledge or whatever. Because, as we mentioned, he has this club of the elite, the Slug Club. And Tom Riddle was given an award for the school. He was a Slytherin and all this stuff. And so it makes sense for Slughorn to say, well, Tom, I guess I can tell you because, you know, you're all high and mighty, you're Slug Club president or whatever.
Yeah.
What future role do you think Slughorn is going to play? Do you think the end of Book 6 sort of closed up his fate?
I don't know.
I'm not sure. I don't think that Joe would have made him head of Slytherin for no reason.
Yeah. I don't think. Why would he have to leave? He wasn't a defense teacher, so there's no jinx on him.
Right, but what role do you think that he is going to play in Book 7? Do you think that he is going to distance himself again like he did in the first war? Or is he going to become more involved with the Order of the Phoenix? Or is he just going to remain neutral?
It depends on where the war goes. Because if the war gets so big that people have to decide what side they're on, or they're just going to get, you know, killed in the whole... In the whole mess of things, you got to figure out what side you're going to be on, and these books are a lot about choices, and maybe he'll come around and make a choice for the better, or, you know, maybe he'll go and fight with the Death Eaters, who knows, but I think it'd be interesting either way to see which side he picks. I don't think he'll stay neutral throughout the whole book.
Well, I'm pretty sure that if he's going to choose any side, he would probably, well, then again, as we mentioned before, he's kind of self-concerned, and he's a very selfish person. And in a way, he's sort of like a strong version of Peter Pettigrew. You understand what I'm saying? Do you see the parallel there? Mm-hmm. You think that it would make sense for him to choose the side that's offering more and choose a side that's more powerful to join?
Not necessarily, because you remember what we saw come out of him when Harry said, "Don't you want to stop the person who killed Lily Evans?" And you saw just how much he really cared about her and how awful he felt about her death. And I really think that Joe had him become head of Slytherin for a reason. I think that Micah had a very valid point in stating a few weeks ago that the Sorting Hat did point out that for Hogwarts to not crumble from within, the houses would have to unite. And I think that Slughorn could have some kind of large role in helping that happen.
Right, and because before, when Snape was the head of house, you know, since you sort of have the Death Eaters' kids within that house, not all of them, like I said, but, you know, just some of them within there, if Snape begins to show allegiance towards the good side, well, I guess it's supposed to be part of his, you know, his gig, but he never really has treated everyone fairly and hasn't really been about, you know, the unity of the school. And I think Slughorn is more, he's more charismatic, and even though he may be a little bit arrogant and conceited, it makes sense for him to be a lot better at bringing them together.
Yeah,
you know,
and I don't know if it was part of the narrative or if he told Harry this, but apparently he was an old friend and colleague of Dumbledore, and he was pretty upset when Dumbledore was when he was killed. And he, you know, I'm quoting again from, I'm looking at the lexicon entry on Slughorn, and it says he's one of the first Slytherins that Harry met who has no prejudices against Muggleborn or half-blood wizards. So, something to consider.
I think that going back to what Ben said about having students of Death Eaters in Slytherin, I think something that's really important to remember about that is that it's actually a very small group of students in there that are children of Death Eaters. I want to say maybe 5 or 6 of them. And really, the rest of the Slytherins are kind of faceless. We haven't seen all that much out of them. I don't think that the Slytherins, apart from Draco and his crowd, are any more evil, snotty, obnoxious than any other teenager. And I think that we're definitely going to get to see more of their role brought out in Book 7 in uniting with the rest of the school.
In a way, Horace Slughorn sort of reminds me of Professor Moody, or I guess Imposter Moody. And just that, you know, it feels like when he's going to say he's going to do something, he's going to lay down the law, you know. And that is, there won't be any messing around. And I think that we can probably expect that from him in Book 7. That's assuming that Hogwarts is going to be open. I think it will be. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
That just makes
sense.
Yeah,
for a little while.
I think it will
be,
too.
Yeah, at least for a little while.
I don't think so.
Why not, Rachel?
Why not, Rachel?
I don't, because there's so much going on that I doubt that it's going to get focused up on. Maybe it will, but I doubt that everything's going to be taking place there, or it'll be, like, hardly mentioned, but I really doubt that the school's going to be open.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is that Hogwarts will be open, but Harry probably won't be there.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Well, that could be a possibility, but the chances of Hogwarts being open, for me, they're probably slim to nothing, I think, because there's just so much going on.
I don't know where a safer, larger place to keep people would be other than Hogwarts.
That's true.
There's chaos happening outside.
Yeah, didn't Dumbledore say that they...
Sorry, James.
I just started rereading Book 6, but I swear that Dumbledore told Harry at the beginning that they had enhanced the protection of Hogwarts a little bit that year. So I don't know if that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think regardless of whether or not it'll be open, I'm not sure that we're going to see much of it.
Yeah, we're probably not going to see that much of it. Yeah.
Although it would be the first time, though.
Well, Back on Slughorn for a second, though, we kind of brought up real quick casually, but you talk so much about how, you know, he's so upset about Lily Evans and on about what was his deal with Lily Evans, especially knowing the kind of people that he has in his Slug Club. Granted, you know, she was a head girl and all, but it's like a big kind of clue to the character of Lily Evans that we're supposed to find out so
much
about.
Sounds like
a lot
of people had a crush on Lily Evans.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
She must have been hot.
He was attracted to the student?
I doubt it.
Physically?
I'm pretty sure it's just... There obviously has to be something that she offered, and, you know, she was head girl, and maybe she was just an exceptional student. As Laura intelligently pointed out, is that Harry noticed about Slughorn that he was the first Slytherin that he's known that hasn't really shown any prejudice towards those who are Muggle-born. And so it probably wouldn't matter to him that she's a Muggle-born.
Well, I think that he would react that way to any student that was in his Slug Club, because he obviously chooses the most talented and, I guess, the most rich or the best looking, whichever way you want to look at it, in his eyes, kids who join his Slug Club. And I think that if he felt like he was the direct cause of one of them getting killed, he'd feel guilty about it no matter what.
Right, and I don't think it's any way, the people he selects for the Slug Club, I don't think it's any way contingent on your wizard ancestry. Yeah, your bloodline. I think it's more of how accomplished you are. And like Dumbledore said, it's our choices who make us who we are. Basically, that's to paraphrase it. And maybe that's the same way Slughorn thinks, that if you choose to be this way, it doesn't matter whether you're a Muggle-born, half-blood, or a pure-blood wizard. What matters is your ability.
Yeah. Or promise.
In his eyes.
Right. You know what I've always thought was strange is that since, you know, back when he was favoring Lily because she was so exceptional and she wasn't in Slytherin, don't you think that the other students probably would have been jealous of, like, Lily, knowing that the teacher was... Well, especially that he was head of house of Slytherin, you'd think that his favorite would have been a Slytherin.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. You get what I mean? I've always thought that was kind of strange. I don't know. That his student wasn't from his own house.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if he shows the same house bias that Snape does.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much what I'm basing it on, but yeah.
Well, I have a feeling that Lily probably got some of the same taunting that Harry has.
Yeah, that's what I think,
just because he favored her. Yeah,
because of that.
I'm sure that happened.
Pretty much got picked on or made fun of because of that. Or she just wasn't liked by some of the students, especially the Slytherins, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that wraps up this week's character discussion, unless you guys have anything else to add.
Nope. Well done, all.
So yeah, I hope everyone enjoyed this week's character discussion. However, the main discussion is not over yet, because we're going on to our second portion, which has to deal with prophecies.
Oh my.
Throughout the series, we've seen prophecies, you know, pretty much they shape basically Harry's destiny and what has made him, quote-unquote, the Chosen One. But we have to beg the question, what exactly is a prophecy? Well, thanks to Jamie Lawrence from MuggleNet.com, most of you know Jamie, he made MuggleNet's section Level 9, you can view that at MuggleNet.com/Level 9, and has a lot of information about prophecies and what they are. A prophecy is defined by Dictionary.com as an inspired utterance of a prophet, viewed as a revelation of divine will, or a prediction. What it seems like in the Harry Potter series is that it's become more than just a mere prediction. Would you guys agree with that? That rather than it just being Trelawney spouting off these things, like that Harry, you know, that Harry was born as the seventh month dies, and that they are the power that the Dark Lord knows not, do you think that that it's more than just a prediction, that it's actually going to happen? Or do you think since she made this prophecy that they choose to make it happen, which is sort of what Dumbledore hinted at?
I think I'd have to agree with what Dumbledore said. It's the choices, what, you know, choices are what makes us who we are, and I think that Dumbledore was very correct in saying that if, you know, Harry or Voldemort had decided they didn't want to have anything to do with the prophecy, then it wouldn't have come true.
That's a very good point. Yeah. I mean, the beginning of the prophecy was a choice. It was either Harry or Neville, you know, and mm-hmm. Voldemort chose and made a choice.
Right. And so the choices sort of shaped the prophecy. You know, people have sort of, not the prophecy, but the outcome of the prophecy. People have always wondered, and it's been in the series a few times too, why couldn't Voldemort and why couldn't Harry just say, this is stupid. Why are we fighting, you know?
Wouldn't make a very interesting story.
You know, why don't we just sit the wands down and be done with it? But they can't do that. Why do you think, you know, of course it would make a very interesting story, but why do you think that can't happen within the series? Do you think that Harry needs to get vengeance for his parents' death, and the way Voldemort's motives is because he's trying to take over the world?
No, I think that the reason it can't happen is because Voldemort is trying to take over, and he doesn't think he can do that unless Harry's dead.
Right.
That's true. I think it's more that Voldemort is after Harry than Harry being after Voldemort, mm-hmm. which is really evidenced throughout the series pretty well, too.
Yeah.
You got Voldemort, who, as much as he has this ambition to take over things, is obviously he's got the ego and the pride to want to be the most powerful being on Earth. And if he knows that there's some kind of prophecy out there that says someone can beat him, a priority is going to be to knock that person or anybody else out who has prophesied that can possibly be more powerful than him or beat him. But what the prophecies that has had me always thinking is the rules of the prophecy as, you know, whether or not it means that, you know, only Harry can kill Voldemort and only Voldemort can kill Harry. If that's supposed to be meant that, you know, people can try to kill them, but they won't succeed because they're more stronger than them, or is it an actual impossibility where if someone were to try to just take an axe to one of those guys, it would bounce right off because they weren't prophesied to be the one to kill the people. That's what I don't know.
Well, that all comes down to the interpretation of the prophecy, which is what we need to get to next. Okay, I'll read the prophecy. This is from Order of the Phoenix. There's also one in Prisoner of Azkaban, but it doesn't really matter because the outcome already actually happened. So, okay. Here we go. The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches, born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies. And the Dark Lord will mark him as equal, but he will have power the Dark Lord knows not, and either must die at the hand of the other, for neither can live while the other survives. The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord will be born as the seventh month dies. Okay, so we need to break down this prophecy a bit. Okay, the parents of the person who can defeat Voldemort will be born to parents who have escaped Voldemort three times. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're being born at the end of July. Voldemort will mark them as their equal in some way, and they'll have a power that Voldemort will not know about, and either they will kill Voldemort or Voldemort will kill them in the end. Because they cannot both exist. Like, there's no coexistence going on here.
Right.
But the real question about the prophecy is, couldn't it be talking about three people? And let me read the sentence here. And either must die at the hand of the other, for neither can live while the other survives.
Right.
Don't you see how it could be talking about three people?
I didn't.
Or am I crazy?
I didn't interpret it that way. I was thinking it was saying, you know, neither can live, neither... referring to the two of them while the other survives, referring to the opposite, which would be Harry's opposite being Voldemort or Voldemort's opposite being Harry. I hadn't interpreted that as being a third person.
Well, I'm just saying that Joe's kind of tricky, so, you know.
Well,
but the prophecy is probably pretty straight up, you know, just mm-hmm. so it'll set up the final showdown, I think. That we're all looking forward
to. Well, we're living in... Well, Harry Potter and Voldemort are living in paradox right now because the prophecy says neither can survive while the other lives, or whatever the other thing is, paraphrase. But, yeah, they're in a paradox right now. So until it's equaled out, they're going to be in this constant flux, constant crisis, and constant battle.
Yeah. I think that... I think the biggest disservice you can do in regarding figuring out this prophecy is paraphrasing it, because of how long Joe says... No, not everybody does it, Jeff. Even I did it. I still do it. But Joe says how long she spent on that prophecy, hours and hours on the words of it alone. And one of the things that I've been thinking about recently is the whole line about neither can live while the other survives. What exactly is she meaning by live? Does it mean live like King Harry cannot live a full life without, well, Voldemort is around because he's always going to be a burden on his mind and he's always going to be connected to him through the scar connection, all that crap.
You know, that's a really good point, John.
And Voldemort can't live the way he wants to with Harry.
Right, I never really looked at
it
that way.
Either. Thank you.
If you redefine the word live, it really brings it into a whole new light, because we don't know if live actually means like the real sense of live
physical
or you're
life.
Dead. Yeah, physical life. Or if it's talking about, like John said, living a full life.
Yeah, your lifestyle, your well-being, your all those things.
Well, we'll find out a little over a year from now. Also, do you guys think it's actually possible for a prophecy not to be fulfilled?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
The people involved have to choose to go through with this prophecy, don't they?
Yeah, but isn't that what makes a prophecy different from a prediction? Is that, you know, if you believe that prophecies are what they say they are, which is things to come, even the choices that are involved still, you know, create the or still fulfill the prophecy. It's just a matter of how. Mm-hmm. The choices, but it's still the prophecy.
Right. It's like when you try to alter history. I'm going to use an example of the new episode of The Twilight Zone that I recently saw was when this lady travels back in time to try to kill baby Hitler. And the mother comes outside while this nanny is trying to kill the baby. And the nanny throws the baby into the water, and the mother starts freaking out because she thinks that she's going to get blamed. So she steals a baby from a homeless woman who's sitting outside, and that baby becomes Hitler. So you see what I'm saying? That no matter how much you try to stop it, it seems that it's always going to end up that way.
Yeah.
I don't know if the Hitler story was necessary, but...
I haven't heard about Hitler in a while.
Nice interlude, yeah.
Yeah.
Hope you get the point. No, okay, point. It's also important to bring up that in Order of the Phoenix, there are other prophecies that actually happen. There's one other prophecies. There's one other prophecy. And it's very interesting. When I read the book, when I was rereading Order of Phoenix for the second time, I started freaking out. Okay, here's what it says. In Order of the Phoenix, there are two prophecies broken, and then you hear snippets of their content. And you hear, at the solstice will come anew, said the figure of an old bearded man, and none will come after, said the figure of an old woman. Okay, after I read Order of the Phoenix, I looked up the definition of a solstice, and I saw that it was June 21st.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened to be the same day that Order of the Phoenix was released. Yeah. So automatically I start freaking out. The solstice will come anew. A new Harry Potter book. And none will come after.
Well, what I just kind of found
and
it
so
interesting.
So I about died.
I found it interesting because I think that that night so many prophecies were broken when they reductoed all the shelves to escape from the Death Eaters. And I think that Joe kind of made a point of having us hear those two little clips. And the way that...
And they're in italics in the book, actually. So that...
Oh, yeah. She almost always has a point.
Exactly. So I think there are multiple ways to interpret that. But when I was kind of reading it, the first thought that came to my mind was that maybe the war with Voldemort would end at the solstice, and that after that, no other evil wizard or no other wizard that could live up to either Harry or Voldemort's status as being able to take over or being able to kind of dominate the entire wizarding world would come.
Right, but don't you think it's more of a war of... Okay, there's the physical war going on, but isn't it also the war of ideologies? People continue... Mm-hmm. I got like two emails about people getting mad about me comparing it to the war on terrorism, but it's sort of the same concept when you say, okay, can you really win the war on terrorism? Can you really win the war? I mean, if you defeat Voldemort, is it really going to stop, to, like, defeat the ideal?
No.
Right.
Not
is
really.
It going to stop racism or whatever, you know, whatever you want to parallel it to with the bloodlines?
Mm-hmm.
And No, that's always going to be there.
It will always be there. But my question is, do we think that anyone like Voldemort is ever going to come along again?
Well, I mean, that's hard to tell. Of course, in the future, there could be somebody who's equally as evil, but...
Ever is a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, even just today's news about Al-Zarqawi being blown up, they're saying, you know, on the War of Terror, the ideal won't die. Someone else will come along that has the same ideals. Whether or not he'll be successful at promulgating these ideas, you know, it's up to history to decide.
Yeah.
And so, does anyone else have any interpretations of the prophecy that we heard after one was broken off the shelf? Because there's a reason Joe put it in there, and I couldn't think past there being any more Harry Potter books. I just started freaking out.
Read it again, Ben. Read it again.
Okay, at the solstice will come anew, said the figure of an old bearded man, and none will come after, said the figure of a young woman. But see, another thing we have to bring up is this talking about the winter solstice or the summer solstice. That's another thing.
Yeah.
Seriously, because there's December 21st and then June 21st. Yeah. So maybe, I don't know, in book six or something that happens in, or,
I don't know.
I guess we'll just have to find out.
It's so confusing. I don't know,
Another definition of solstice I just looked up is the highest point or culmination. That's the entire definition.
So we don't know if it's actually talking about a date, like at the solstice?
Right, or just the culmination of the battle or the war.
Mm-hmm. But what will come anew? Will come anew what, though, Jeff?
A new world.
A new
life.
Yeah.
And none will come after.
Maybe no other wars. Maybe no other huge battles like that.
Okay, if Harry Potter ends in world peace for all...
I'm not saying world peace. I'm saying none will come after in such a large scale. Mm-hmm. Or something along those lines.
Maybe in regards to Harry in particular, none... You know, he'll be all set.
Yeah.
He's home free.
Yeah. Maybe it's about him.
Just him. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess so. Okay, and then the last part of this discussion... Professor Trelawney, most of the time her predictions and stuff are really off the wall. How do you guys think that true seers come about, and how often do they come about? Because we've seen Trelawney make two predictions that appear to be accurate now. And in the meantime, between those predictions, you know, she's spouting off about the Grimm, you see the Grimm, you know, and stuff like that. And so, how often do you guys think that true seers come about?
Well, let me get this straight. You're saying Trelawney's not a real seer?
No.
Well, I guess it kind of comes down to the question of, can you be born, like, sort of partially a seer? Or can you be born a full seer? We haven't really seen any seers outside of Trelawney. And we don't know how many... correct prophecies they've made in their lifetime. And we've seen that there's a good number of them at the Department of Mysteries, so either there's a very small number of people who produce a lot of them, or there's a large number of people who don't produce that many.
Right, and are all seers the same way as Trelawney, you know, as Laura mentioned? Is it that every once in a blue moon that they predict a true prophecy, or like a real prophecy is what I'm saying, or is it... Or are there some people who they come to them all the time?
Well, I want to know about the whole divination thing. Is there anything to the reading tea leaves and reading crystal balls and all that junk? Or are true seers able to just, you know, things just come to them? I don't think every good seer speaks your prophecies in the weird, deep, crazy voice like Trelawney does. I think that you're just getting...
getting into it?
Basically just... No, she... I think that's her... was it her grandma who was the famous seer that Dumbledore talked about?
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe she was channeling this woman in her family, or she was using Sybil as a vessel for this such an important prophecy that somehow it was transcending, death or wherever, you know. I don't know if we know that What's-Her-Face is dead or not.
Wow, I never thought of it that way before. That's pretty interesting.
John Noe, you're completely underrated. I'm serious.
No.
You're great.
Stop.
Okay, well, that wraps up the final portion of our main discussion this week. If you have any listener rebuttals concerning these discussions, remember, email us at mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com. Now it's time for this. It's for everybody's favorite segment.
Oh.
This week's Give Me a Butterbeer.
Yay! I want to do one next.
Give Me a Butterbeer is back again this week. This week's topic is very timely, considering we have two older HP fans on the show. Catch that, Jeff. I said older.
Who's that?
Old.
Oh, okay.
Not old. Harry Potter has received many accolades as an adult book, and many critics claim that the series is meant solely for children. Which begs the question, and this week's topic, is Harry Potter for kids or adults? Well, personally, I didn't jump on the Harry Potter bandwagon until I was in 8th grade. One day I needed a book for silent reading time, so I grabbed Harry Potter off of the shelf. As an 8th grader, I started getting made fun of by the other kids for reading something as childish as Harry Potter. Anyone listening to this show knows that the Harry Potter series isn't just for people ages 8 to 12. It's for everyone. Look at the way that Joe has written the series. It's far too complex for someone as young as 10 to be capable of understanding. As I've reread the series, as I've gotten older, I've begun to pick up more and more on the subtle nuances of the series, and it all becomes clearer in my mind. The beauty of the Harry Potter books is that it can be looked at from so many different perspectives. You have the casual 10-year-old who wants to read the series for the storyline of a boy wizard fighting evil. Then you have people like the people on this show who read the series analytically and try to discover what's coming next. Of course, you'll have the older fans who read the series out of curiosity to see what all the craze is about. So it's obvious that Harry isn't just for kids. It's for everyone of all ages. Joe's work deserves all of the awards it has received. We all agree that the Harry Potter books are like no other. J.K. has invested an incredible amount of time into tangling a web for her readers to try and follow. She deserves credit for that, whether it's in the form of a Harry Potter fan site or in the form of an adult book award. I felt uncomfortable when I first began to read the HP series. I felt out of place, like a social misfit. As my love for Harry grew, I began to see that there are millions of other people out there like me. We're not freaks, we're just Harry Potter fans. I'm Ben Shane, and I say, give me a butterbeer.
Wow.
That's good, Ben. You know, can I answer your butterbeer just briefly?
Yeah, go ahead and talk. The discussion following this.
Oh, I didn't know that was allowed.
Yeah.
Okay. I've always thought that the reason so many people are so quick to call it a children's book is look at what would happen if you call it an adult book. It's very easy for those critics or for the people who defend the series from the people who say it's all about witchcraft and, you know, occult and all of that crap, and to just say, oh, you know, they're just for kids, you know, and it's easy to just brush it under the table like that. But it takes much more effort for people to try to categorize a book that is about, you know, things like imaginary witches and wizards and magics and, you know, coexisting magical societies, and call that an adult book, because that really goes against the frame of mind for many adults in a society today that imagination is just something that has gone into, you know, neglect, and it's such a serious world out there, and not many people of adult age that, you know, especially the ones that don't have children, often use their imaginations anymore. So to call it an adult book, to have that be accepted by the society, is for the society to also accept their own imaginations, and I don't think...
Right. But John, by the same line of thinking, do you think that the same people who consider Harry Potter a children's book would consider Lord of the Rings a children's book? I think that has a lot to do with the way that, you know, the series is written. Like I said, that it's like no other. A 10-year-old would have a lot harder time reading Lord of the Rings and making any sense of it whatsoever. Like I said, that we try to read the books and analyze them and find out what's coming next, and we can read into more in depth into the storyline than a 10-year-old could. But at the same time, a 10-year-old can understand what is going can understand what is going on in Harry Potter to a certain extent.
No, the only big difference there is that as small as those little hobbits are, I think we're to understand that they're 40 years old in hobbit years, and everybody, the main characters of Harry Potter, are children. So for adults to identify with these children takes another disconnection that is very seldom made. And Lord of the Rings are all pretty much, you know, adults, and like an action fantasy novel.
I think that that's one of the things that I just love so much about Harry is it is such a hard book to categorize. I've been reading these books since I was 11, and I can definitely say that the way that I've, you know, the reasons that I've been reading them have definitely changed. When I first started reading them, it was, these are fun books, they're really good, I love the plots, and I love the characters, and I love to go outside and pretend like my tree is a whomping willow and all this other silly stuff. And now it's for the fact that, wow, I can actually sit here and analyze this, and I can feel really intelligent when I think I've picked up on something, and it's just one of the most awesome things ever, and it's why I love Harry. And I think that another important thing to say about the series is the fact that while it is not easily categorized as a book for a specific age group, I don't think that it's necessarily a fantasy book either. I think that it has fantasy elements. It has witches and wizards and magic and wands. But I think that a lot of the storyline and the plot line, in essence, is more of a mystery or a suspense. And it's just another thing that I respect Jo for, because she's able to make this such a dynamic story, and you can look at it from so many different angles and directions.
I agree yes. with that. I mean,
amen, Laura.
Everyone has a story of how they got into Harry Potter, and I can't believe now it's been 6 years. I picked up the book one, in 2000. That's the first time I got into it. And then right after I read the first book, or maybe it was the second or third or fourth, I got all the way through in that summer, and I went online immediately and tried to find other adult fans who liked Harry Potter. That was my first goal coming online. I was like, I wonder, there must be some small group of people, adults, that like to talk about Harry Potter online and discuss what could be coming. And lo and behold, there's an entire world online of adults and for kids. And it's just, you know, such a breath of fresh air. I mean, you know, Ben, you said in your commentary that maybe, you know, some kids were not capable of understanding it. I think it's more that different age levels have a different understanding of it. And I think you did touch on that too in your commentary, which is, you know, the kids see the magic and the, you know, sorcery and all that. And the adults see this very mature social storytelling about the plight of, you know, social injustice and racism. And that really was what got me and thinking, you know, this isn't just a kid's book. It's for everybody. And it has layers for everybody.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, if you have any comments for me or for anyone else's opinions, please email ben@staff.mugglenet.com about this segment. I'm really starting to like this segment. I think the fans are too.
I've loved this segment since the very first one.
Well, folks, it's time to lighten things up a bit. We've been analyzing everything for the past hour or so. So it's time for a little bit of Spy on Sparks.
Yay! I'm so excited!
Oh, God.
I haven't talked to Alex in so long. What is he up to, Ben?
I don't know.
Not much. Now he is on summer vacation.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we actually get to call him?
Yeah, we're calling him.
It's magical.
It is magical.
Oh, no. Hold on. Well, we're still going to find a way to spy on
him. Aren't you supposed to give out a digit of his number?
Well, no, hold on. We'll call La Casa de Sparts.
You know, when,
hold on,
when
guys.
Mr. Bigglesworth gets upset, you know what happens.
Yeah.
People die! Oh, here we go. Is Emerson home?
Hold on.
Is that Papa?
Yeah.
Aw, why don't I talk to Papa?
Shh, be quiet.
Shh.
Get Dylan on the phone. Oh, shh.
All of you. Hey, Emerson, what are you doing? Hey, Emerson, what are you doing? Oh, that's awesome. Did you win?
Yeah, that's why Dylan walked off.
Oh, you smashed him, didn't you?
You know Dylan.
Yeah, I know Dylan. Hey, we're spying on Sparts, so say hi to everybody. Yeah, we got Jeff Guillaume and John. So, Emerson, why weren't you on this week? I invited you to be on this week. Why didn't you join us?
Oh, I had a serious
football game. Oh, jeez, that's just too bad. You're lucky. You're lucky you answered, because I was about to give out a digit of your phone number, and we're one of these times we're going to get all the way through them, and next thing you know, your cell phone's going to be bombarded with phone calls.
You know how many combinations there are of seven numbers?
Yeah, so you better start answering your cell phone. You lucked out today. I said I'd call your house and let that count, so.
Lucky me, because my cell phone doesn't work.
Oh, that's true. Oh, geez. How many phones have you gone through now?
I think I'm on number 8.
Ouch. Listen to this poor kid.
You suck.
Okay, Emerson, well, we're done spying on you. We wanted to see what was up. Okay. See ya. What's that? Oh, we will. You have fun playing football. See ya, dude. So, that was this week's Spy on Sparts. I hope you all enjoyed that.
So exciting.
I sure did.
Yay.
It was a nice
little
break.
I didn't know you guys still did that.
Oh, yeah. We started this thing where we give out a digit of his phone number if he doesn't answer the phone.
Well, you realize that there are 5,040 different combinations of seven numbers?
There are more than that, isn't there?
And that's not
seven
even
factorial.
Including an area code. Though I guess if we know where he lives, you could get area codes.
And who doesn't? I mean, oh, what?
Yeah. I thought he lives in Kansas, doesn't he?
Yeah.
That's where all the
they know the PO box. They know that's where I live.
That's where all the cool kids live.
Okay, we're going to wrap up this week's show. I think it's been a good show. I've enjoyed casting with all you guys.
Oh, it's fun. Aww.
It's a good, good group.
I like calling
you
casting.
Yeah, that was cute. Casting with an apostrophe.
What are you?
Casting? Yeah, with no G.
Oh, casting.
No G.
That is how the cool kids say it.
We are older, so.
We have to get in with the lingo with
yeah.
The kids.
Thanks for that, Ben.
Okay. Well, so this is our Harry Potter favorite segment. I say something, you tell me what your favorite is. Your favorite Weasley. Go, Jeff.
Oh, Ron.
Why?
Oh, I have to say why. Because he's cool. I don't know. No, he's a loyal friend, and he's funny, and he's just average. You know, he's like a your buddy. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. Laura.
Oh, Ron! Absolutely, Ron. Probably mostly because he reminds me of one of my best friends. So it kind of cracks me up to read them because I read it and I think, oh, so.
What about you, Rachel?
Percy.
Percy? Oh,
which is your favorite?
Yes.
Rachel is what we call an outlier. Okay?
Oh, Rachel.
She's crazy. She's rad.
Really? Percy? Because he's fun to hate on. He's like the only Weasley that I can't stand, so it's fun to hate him. So, don't like him.
Okay, what about you, John? Who?
Oh, my. I think it would have to be Ginny Weasley.
Ginny Weasley?
Ew!
You're not allowed to ask me why.
Oh, God.
Yeah, we won't.
Okay, my favorite Weasley... Yeah, probably Ginny.
Yeah.
Oh, please.
She's a sweetheart. You know, just those love scenes, you know, the kissing scenes and Half-Blood Prince just warmed my heart. Made me insanely jealous of Harry.
Oh, my God.
Is that all that it warmed there, Ben?
Yeah, that's all... John.
What?
Oh,
your
God.
Mind and your soul.
So I think that wraps up MuggleCast episode 43. I've had a good time doing the show with all you guys. You know, this goes.
Fun.
You know what this proves right here? This proves that the show will go on without Andrew Sims. High fives all around.
Don't tell him that.
High fives.
Slap hands.
And it's also good for inner house relations, I believe.
Yeah.
from the Mufflenet house, the Leaky house, and the HPNA house.
Yeah,
and
Tom Felton .ws house.
this is quite a diverse show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm Ben Shane. It was a pleasure. I'm Ben Shane.
I'm Laura Thompson.
I'm Rachel Godoy. Bye.
And you two are?
Oh, I'm John. No way. And my name's hilarious.
Yeah.
And I'm Jeff.
Guillaume from
Guillaume.
It's an acronym.
Yeah.
Good show, guys.
Get it, 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 get it